From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 38 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. Coming up on this edition, a report about how sooner is better than later when it comes to treating HIV-infected infants. Wally Akinso has a story about how it doesn't matter if it's diet or regular, people who indulge in soft drinks are at an increased risk of developing metabolic syndrome. I'll have a report on how treating expectant mothers with a female hormone known as progesterone did not prove to be useful in preventing preterm birth in women carrying twins. And Lauren Waddell will tell you about some new, faster-acting antidepressant drugs that are in the works. But first, an interesting study shows that your social networks may have something to do with your body style. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Uterine fibroids, the most common non-cancerous tumors of the uterus. If you're suffering with uterine fibroids and are between the ages of 25 and 50, the NIH invites you to take part in a clinical study. All study tests and related treatments are provided at no cost and compensation is provided. For more info, call 866-999-5053 or log on to clinicaltrials.gov. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Your social network of friends and family seems to have an influence on your chances for developing obesity. That's the finding of a study funded by the National Institute on Aging, part of the National Institutes of Health. The study showed that obesity spreads within social networks and that the closer the social connection, the greater the influence on developing obesity, even if people live in different households many miles apart. Dr. Richard Sisman, director of the Behavioral and Social Science Program at the NIA, explained the significance of the study.
There are important implications, one of which is that it may be quite difficult to lose weight by oneself, and it may be much easier to lose it as part of a group or a network. And I think some of the weight loss groups have recognized this.
A sedentary lifestyle and increased consumption of high-calorie foods are critical factors in the steep rise in the prevalence of obesity, the researchers noted. But the study suggested that a hierarchy of influence exists among family and friends on developing obesity, in which attitudes, behaviors, and acceptance of obesity might also play an important role. Now, while these findings may give pause to a person fighting the battle of the bulge, this is not to say you should ditch your overweight friends or shun your chubby relatives. In fact, Dr. Sisman said, the opposite is true.
It helps if you can get the support of friends and you work on it together. And let me say this, there are other data that show that friends and social relationships have a substantial impact on people's health and indeed longevity. So keep all the friends you have, make more.
The findings were published in the July 26, 2007 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. And on the subject of obesity and potential heart disease, it turns out that it doesn't matter whether that soda is diet or regular, not as far as your chances of developing metabolic syndrome are concerned. Wally Akinso has the details.
Are you a middle-aged adult? Do you drink more than one soft drink per day? It doesn't matter if it's diet or regular. According to a study by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute at the National Institutes of Health, you may have a more than 40% greater rate of either having or developing metabolic syndrome. That's a cluster of conditions that increase the risk for heart disease. While the increased risk of metabolic syndrome associated with high-calorie, high-sugar, regular soft drinks might be expected, the similar risk found among those drinking diet sodas may cause a few raised eyebrows, according to Dr. Caroline Fox, co-author of the study.
What's very intriguing about this study's finding is that it was both regular and diet soft drinks that were associated with the metabolic syndrome. And what these results suggest is that soft drink consumption, whether diet or regular, may be a marker for increased metabolic syndrome risk.
Dr. Fox said the findings point to the importance of long-term observational studies, which allow researchers to take a closer look at how aspects of diet are interrelated with health risks. The results are from the Framingham Heart Studies, Soft Drink Consumption and Risk of Developing Cardiometabolic Risk Factors, and the Metabolic Syndrome in Middle-Aged Adults in the Community, which was published online in the Circulation in July. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, Lauren Waddell will tell us about some new faster-acting antidepressants that may be available soon. That's next on NIH Research Radio. A key to good health is eating healthy foods. So, dash to the produce aisle for fruits and vegetables. Dash to the dairy case for low-fat milk products. Dash to the foods that are lower in saturated fat, trans fat, cholesterol, sodium, and added sugars. Dash to foods that help in the fight against high blood pressure. For more information, visit www.dashplan.org. This message brought to you by the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. One of the problems with the current stable of antidepressant medications is they seem to take so long to become effective. But those days may soon be over. Lauren Waddell has the story.
In the past, those who suffer from depression have often had to wait many weeks or even months for their antidepressant treatment to start kicking in. Now, scientists at the National Institute of Mental Health, part of the National Institutes of Health, are discovering new ways to develop faster-acting antidepressant medications, ones that may start working in just a few hours. The most recent treatment is a drug called ketamine. Though it is not on the market due to certain side effects, researchers believe it holds great potential in the search for faster-acting antidepressants. The rewards of having faster-acting treatments would be immense, both on a personal and public health level, according to Dr. Carlos Zarate, chief of the Mood and Anxiety Disorders Research Unit at the NIMH, who worked on the study that developed and researched ketamine.
The problems with the delay in onset of antidepressant action is people suffer tremendously. People may be bedridden. They may have disruption in their personal, professional lives. For example, they can't hold their job. They might have problems with marriage, raising their children, because if you're away for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, literally, unable to function adequately, that really disrupts your life. Not only that, there's an increased risk of suicide during the first month until our antidepressant takes effect. So imagine if you could have an antidepressant effect within hours or even one day, you would minimize the disruption in the personal professional life of that individual. And in theory, one could argue that you would decrease the risk for suicide in the sense that you're relieving depressive symptoms very rapidly, in hours or a day as opposed to weeks or months.
Dr. Zarate suggested that as researchers come closer to developing faster-acting antidepressants, minus the difficult side effects present in ketamine, the true magnitude of these treatment options will become apparent. For more information on depression and current treatment options, visit NIMH on their website at www.nimh.nih.gov/health-information. From the National Institutes of Health, I'm Lauren Waddell in Bethesda, Maryland.
Treating expectant mothers with a female hormone known as progesterone did not prove to be useful in preventing preterm birth in women carrying twins. According to a study supported by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, part of the National Institutes of Health, previous studies had shown that progesterone therapy was helpful in preventing preterm birth in women who carry a single child who were at risk because of a previous preterm birth. Dr. Catherine Spong, chief of the Pregnancy and Perinatology Branch of the NICHD, explains.
We tested in women who had twins and in women who had triplets, did the addition of progesterone at the same time period, starting in between 16 and 20 weeks and going through delivery, prevent preterm birth. And it was not efficacious. It did not reduce preterm birth in that cohort.
Dr. Spong said this means physicians should not assume that progesterone therapy is useful in preventing preterm birth in all groups of at-risk pregnant women.
Clearly, preterm birth is a major public health issue, and we need to be able to reduce the rates of preterm birth, but there's no magic bullet. And progesterone is not something that everyone should be taking. We need to identify the women who meet the needs for progesterone, give them progesterone, and find other ways to stop the preterm births in the other groups, such as multifetal gestation.
Researchers will continue to test the effectiveness of progesterone on other at-risk women, such as women with shortened cervixes and women pregnant with triplets. When we come back, how sooner is better than later when it comes to treating HIV-infected infants. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Aristotle had this problem, so did Thomas Jefferson, and they went on to do great things. If you stutter, you could do something great too by participating in a National Institutes of Health stuttering study. Participants will be compensated, travel assistance is available, and all study-related tests are provided at no cost. Call 866-999-5553 or visit clinicaltrials.gov. Do something great. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. When it comes to treating infants infected with HIV, earlier is better than later. That's what's been learned from the initial results of an ongoing clinical trial in South Africa, sponsored by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, part of the National Institutes of Health, which showed that more HIV-infected infants survive if they're given therapy early on, regardless of their apparent state of health. NIAID Director Dr. Anthony S. Fauci explains.
Children were looked at with regard to what the most appropriate time to treat them is, vis-a-vis the long-range positive or negative effect. And groups of children were treated sooner rather than later, and another group was treated only when the CD4 count dropped to a certain level indicating that there was clear-cut progression of disease. So the fundamental principle is either treat early before you get evidence of deterioration or wait until you start to see evidence of deterioration. And those two components of the study were compared. And at the end of the study, it became very, very clear that the children who were treated earlier did far better than those that were not treated until it was very clear that they needed to be treated. So the thinking now is leaning much more towards earlier treatment in children for the long-term benefits of that.
This finding came to light after a routine review by the trial's Data and Safety Monitoring Board, an independent committee that regularly reviews interim data from the study to ensure the safety of participants. As a result of these preliminary findings, Dr. Fauci said all children in the study will now be treated sooner, rather than waiting to see if they show signs of deterioration.
The data was so powerful to indicate that the children who were treated earlier as opposed to delayed did so much better that would have been unethical to continue the limb of the study to delay treatment in other children.
For more information, log on to www.niaid.nih.gov. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, August 24th, when episode 39 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio, the Health Star Radio Network, and online at www.federalnewsradio.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. That email address, ws159h@nih.gov. Once again, that email address is ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.